Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program brought to you by the Pacifica Network that analyzes the major economic events and trends, the forces shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, everything that we buy and what we pay for the goods and services that we all depend on. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I'm a visiting professor in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Please keep sending in your questions and comments. We read every one and select a few we can respond to on the air, but we also use them to shape our program. Send your questions and comments, as always, to our websites democracyatwork.info or rdwolf.com, either way. And if you would like us to identify you by name, please let us know. Today's shorter economic updates, with which we open all our programs, has to continue from last week. And that is with the remarkable story of a remarkable little country, Cyprus. To remind everyone, Cyprus is a small island nation in the middle of the Mediterranean. It has approximately 1 million people, making it a very small country by most standards. And it has been in the news because the economic crisis afflicting capitalism around the world has come down particularly hard in that particular country at this particular moment. If you think Greece had problems, and you recall that when we've been discussing the Greek problems, we said that they were a harbinger of the same or worse to come, well, Cyprus confirms that. The Cyprus situation is even worse. And here's the basic story. Cyprus, 1 million people, live on basically three industries. Shipping, because they're an island nation. Tourism, because they have a wonderful climate in the middle of that sea that is a resort, if you like. And finally, their banking system. All three industries have been badly hit by the global capitalist crisis. People from other parts of the world who used to require shipping in or out of Cyprus or using Cypriot ships don't need them anymore, anywhere near as much. People affected by the crisis across Europe can't take vacations in places like Cyprus the way they once did. So their tourism and their shipping industries have been hurt. But what was hurt the most was their banking industry. In order to become a well-off economy, the capitalist banks of Cyprus decided to become a special kind of bank. They welcomed, they invited wealthy people and corporations from around the world who had currencies that were not global to deposit those currencies and get them exchanged for euros in Cyprus's banks. The Cyprus banks would pay them a hefty interest rate, better than what they could get in much of the rest of Europe. And then they would turn around and invest the money that was deposited in their banks, making a hefty profit for the Cyprus banks. In other words, everybody took advantage of the capitalist system when things were good in the 1980s, in the 1990s, and into the early years of this century. But capitalism's fundamental instability, its tendency to have cycles that plunge downward periodically, began doing that in 2007, and here we are 6 years later, and we're still in the crisis with no end in sight. And it has hit Cyprus very, very hard. It turns out that while the blow to tourism and shipping, as I explained, was significant, it was nothing compared to the blow to banking. Turns out the private banks that took all those deposits from around the world and from, of course, Cypriot citizens too, had invested them badly, had not understood the risks they were taking, had not hedged or compensated for those risks. Rather like banks in most other parts of the world, they didn't perform well, which in the case of Cyprus is an understatement. So suddenly, when the private tourism businesses and the private shipping businesses and the private banks began to fail, they turned to the government to bail them out. But the problem is the banks were so bad off, had lost so much, had made so many bad investments, that what they needed was enormous. And put together with the broader crisis, the Cyprus government turned to Europe and said, please bail us out. And what we need is 17 billion euros, which it turns out is the equal, roughly, of the annual output of goods and services of the entire country, 17 billion. To understand what that means, consider this. If the United States had to borrow an amount of money equal to its GDP, its output of goods and services in a year, we would have had to borrow $15 trillion. So you can tell Cyprus is in trouble. The Europeans were willing to help, but not the whole 17. And they said, quite correctly, given the situation, that to lend a government an amount of money, and remember the government was already in debt from previous borrowings, to lend them an amount of money equal their total annual output would put them in a kind of debt straitjacket, which would be impossible to carry over the years ahead. It would condemn the Cyprus economy to a miserable existence, unlike what they've had in the past, for an indefinite number of years. So the Europeans said, we'll lend you $10 billion, that's a lot anyway, and you're going to have to raise the other $7 billion you need from your own resources. The Cyprus government said, our economy is reeling. If we tapped our own resources, we would destroy our economy. The Europeans wouldn't budge. So here's what they came up with in meetings 10 days ago. They would solve the problem by raising the other $7 billion, that is, $10 billion would come from Europe, plus $7 billion would be raised inside Cyprus. They would do this by, get ready now, because here's something being done that has not been done before. The government would simply go into everyone's bank account and take money out. If you had an account over 100,000 euros, 10% of it would be taken. And if you had an account less than that, 6.25% would be taken. This is a new kind of whacking of an economy. This is a new way of taking the money of average people who had nothing to do with this crisis and who got no bailouts to this point and saying, you're going to have to pay the freight to compensate and offset the disastrous investments made by banks in which you deposited your money. It is mind-blowing if you think about it, which is why I'm spending this much time on it. The people of Cyprus got furious, and they went out in demonstrations weekend before last, and they changed everything. They said, we won't tolerate it, and they forced the government in Europe, the government in Cyprus, to back down. And the new arrangement, solidified the following week, is as follows. And let me assure you that this will change again, but as of this broadcast, here's the story. People with accounts in the bank of less than $100,000 will not be tapped. That was the force of the people. It was a victory of the people of Cyprus. You are not going to take our savings that we deposited honestly in the insured accounts in your bank and use them to compensate the same bank for its mess-ups, for its failed investments. But then what was the government going to do if it couldn't tap the accounts below? Here's what they did. They decided to tap the accounts of richer people, those who had more than $100,000, who are now expected to be tapped for the following. 40% of their deposits will be taken from them. Not repaid, not borrowed, simply taken. Big depositors, many of whom are foreigners, they're not from Cyprus, are being told that because the bank in which they deposited their money failed in its proper duty, made terrible errors, they, the depositors, will be required to pay. It's a new step. It shows you how desperate the crisis is and how far the politicians and bankers, and by now they're basically the same people, how far they're willing to go to make people who have nothing to do with this crisis pay for its costs. It's austerity on steroids. It's extraordinary. And guess what the message here is for everyone? Watch out. As this crisis continues, and I'm speaking here not just of Cyprus, not just of Greece, of all of Europe and of the United States too, as the costs keep mounting, as the crisis continues, as the politicians fail to end it, they will be required to find ever more new sources of money to pay the cost. They don't want to charge the large corporations. They don't want to charge the wealthy in their society. They're coming up with other plans. And this extension to depositors in banks is or should be a wake-up call for everyone. The banks opened on Thursday of the last Thursday in March in Cyprus. Everyone knows that depositors in Cyprus are going to desperately try to pull their money out of these banks because given the prognosis of the Cypriot economy, who knows when the government will come again with Europe's backing and take more of their deposits. They're not going to wait. In order to control that situation, because it could collapse the Cyprus economy tomorrow, just imagine if millions of people, or 1 million in that country, and all the foreign depositors pull their money out of Cyprus and move it to another country. That will make a bad situation in Cyprus twice as bad. So the government has had to react, and here's what it's done. You can't take more than a few hundred euros out of the cash machine. You can't take more than 5,000 euros a month out of your accounts in any form, for any purpose. They can't leave the country. There is a new kind of reality. If you have a euro, their currency over there, in another part of Europe, you're free, under the rules of the European Union, to move it at will. If you have money in a Cyprus bank, you have no freedom at all. What this is going to do to the future of banks, their biggest industry, is incalculable, except we know it's bad. This is a sign to be paid attention to. A small corner of the world economy, but powerful in what it teaches and what it suggests. In other short updates before we turn to our major conversations today, I wanted to note that last week was the 50th anniversary of a famous court case in the United States called Gideon versus Wainwright. 50 years ago, there was a case brought by an itinerant fellow named Gideon who was up before a state court in the United States for a crime that would have involved considerable jail time. He had no lawyer. And as a result, the judge, this is in 1962, said, okay, if you can't afford it, you don't have a lawyer. And as a result, he was found guilty and sentenced to 5 years in jail. This case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that any defendant in a state court in any of the 50 states of the United States who faced significant jail time had to be provided with legal representation whether or not he or she could afford it. It was, all the justices agreed, a basic commitment to equal justice before the law to do that. So here we are 50 years later. Are we grateful for such a law? I hope so. Has it helped people along the way? Definitely. But it's one thing to guarantee legal counsel. It's another thing to guarantee the kind of legal counsel that a person ought to be able to access whatever he or she has to spend. Either you provide equal justice or you don't. And the truth is, and this is something documented by a law professor at the University of Georgia named Erica Hashimoto, that in fact, we don't provide equal justice, even with the Gideon versus Wainwright decision. The truth of the matter is, as this Professor Hashimoto documents, that many, many defendants in state courts are represented by lawyers who have hundreds of these clients, can't possibly give each one of them the kind of attention that a proper defense requires. So, yes, it's better than nothing, but we still have a long way to go before we provide real equality of justice. Instead, we have a market system. You get the justice that you can afford. We have the best justice, you might say, that money can buy. And I leave it to all of you to ask whether that's an appropriate way to organize things. Third quick update. This one comes from a very famous center. It's called the National Opinion Research Center, NORC, which is affiliated with the University of Chicago in Illinois. And they do wonderful research. And in late March of 2013, they released the results of a study. And what they had studied, and what I want to bring to your attention, is what happened in the Great Recession, as it's called, since 2007 and 8. What happened to jobs? Well, we know, as the big fact, that the unemployment rate before the crisis hit, 2007, was about 4.8%, and that it zoomed up in 2009 and 10 to about 10%. And it has come down since then to about 7.5, 7.6%, depending on how you count, which means it's only halfway back to where it was. And let's remember that 4.8% still means millions of people without a work. So there is no recovery in the labor market. But here comes the results of the NORC study. Let me read the key sentences to you. During the Great Recession that began in 2008, about one half of the U.S. jobs lost were middle-class positions, but only about 2% of the jobs gained in the recovery pay middle-class wages. And here, by the way, the cutoff is $35,000 a year. In other words, not only have we not recovered the jobs lost in the Great Recession, but even the jobs that have been recovered are jobs at a lower standard of living, a lower rate of pay. Wow. What this means, they point out, and the document is interesting, is that people who have degrees are being hired for jobs that didn't used to require them. And people who don't have degrees, in the end, face the worst possible conditions. Okay, for the final short update, a lesson, we might say, from China. And the statistics from China are remarkable, so I want to stress them with you. Most recently, China is discovering that what is the good news for a while can become the bad news. What was the good news in China? The good news in China was that wages were so low that companies from around the world, and particularly from the United States, Europe, and Japan, moved to China, closed their factories and offices in the countries where they were born and grew up, and moved to China to take advantage, above all, of the low wages. To give you an idea, I looked it up, and in Wuhan, a very important industrial center, in China, where there are factories of the Japanese automaker Nissan and the Japanese automaker Honda. The basic wage in the auto factories is $333 a month. An American auto worker would not accept and would not be paid that amount of money in a week because it would be too small. So you can see what the attraction has been. Low wages in China, bringing jobs. But of course, if you move your production to China, you get the advantage of low wages, but you get a disadvantage, which is you have to bring the finished car all the way back to the United States. You have to ship it on a ship that takes a long time. You have to pay all the labor costs. You have to pay all the energy costs to move that ship across the oceans. So you have a lot of extra costs. But the wages are so much lower that even after you add all the costs of loading it on the ship, moving it across the ocean, unloading it here in the United States, and shipping it by train to the various showrooms where you finally buy these cars, it's still an advantage. And so China had an economic boom in the last 25 years as the world's capitalists took advantage of the low wages of working people in China. But all good things like that come to an end. Capitalist corporations have been upset in recent years because the wages in China are rising. And they're rising for two reasons. There's a limit to the number of people. China has become the manufacturing center for the world, and they don't have an unlimited number of young people, because that's who they want, people with a lot of energy who can work many, many hours, as they typically do, often under poor conditions. And those workers are not limitless in number. Moreover, as they become workers, they learn about what the conditions are of auto workers in other parts of the world, and they're not too thrilled with their conditions and their pay. There have been strikes, there have been workers' actions, they are demanding more. There have been exposés in the newspapers around the world of the horrific conditions, for example, at the Foxconn Corporation in China, which makes so many Apple products here in the United States, and so on. End result, wages are going up. And capitalists are saying, goodness, if the wages keep going up, then the advantage of going to China, especially when you count the shipping costs and all the other extras, are disappearing. And so they are beginning to look elsewhere. And here's where they're looking. First, to Vietnam. What is the monthly wage for a factory worker in Vietnam as compared to China? Well, China, as I told you, in Wuhan, $333 a month. Hanoi, $111 a month. Phnom Penh in Cambodia, $82 a month. And in Dhaka, in Indonesia and the Philippines, as little as $78 a month. And so businesses are beginning to leave China. This is a very serious affair. Why? Over the last 20 years, hundreds of millions of Chinese working people have left the farms, have left the rural areas, have left the countryside to take up residence in China's booming cities and to find jobs in industry. There has been a fantastic social change, rural to urban, agriculture to industrial, something that took hundreds of years in the West to accomplish in Europe and the United States has been done in decades in China. The reverberations of this will shape Chinese and world society for decades to come. But meanwhile, what in the world will China do if the jobs in industry to which all those hundreds of millions of people moved start leaving because capitalists are driven by profit, not by the social changes they cause and not by the social disasters their leaving implies? We know from what happened in the United States to places like Detroit, Cleveland, Camden, New Jersey, and many others when capitalists left. China got the benefit as capitalists went there, but China now faces the problem of what will happen and what to do if they become a victim of the same profit-maximizing mobile capital that once transformed China into the modern industrial powerhouse it now is. Let me take a short break here, as we normally do, and I'll be right back after these messages.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. owned by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of
As we
fire.
Turn to the longer and a bit more detailed analysis of major stories, I wanted to respond to many of your questions about workers' co-ops. And in particular, many of you seem rightly concerned to ask the question, how could worker co-ops, a way of organizing business so different from the typical capitalist top-down kind of business organization, how could they get going? And more particularly, where would the money come from? Where could it come from to enable collective, democratically owned and operated businesses to get off the ground or to grow if they've already been established? So I thought I would take you through quickly five different ways that workers' co-ops have in fact already shown the capacity to raise money, so that you not only get an analysis of how it could be done, but an analysis based in concrete historical fact. Okay, first, obviously, the government can be, and in many ways ought to be, the source of money. The government could give grants to start these kinds of companies, grants of money, for example, on condition that workers had a solid business plan, that it included a democratically run business where all the workers together would make the decisions, that they had a market that they had identified that they could serve, etc., that the government could provide them with seed money, with grants of money. Likewise, the government could alternatively provide loans, for example, at an interest rate that was either lower than the market rate or where the interest could be deferred for a few years so the company could get off the ground and then pay back the interest. These kinds of things have been done in various countries at various times. There's plenty of experience with how to do that and how to make that work. It's also possible for the government to offer to be a partner. For example, it could be a partner with a trade union to establish a worker-run business. It could be a partner with a community organization. The government could be a partner with churches, synagogues, mosques that were interested in helping their parishioners by developing enterprises that were cooperative in nature. So that either on its own or as a partner, the government could provide important seed capital for building or expanding worker-owned co-ops. And the rationale, we should be clear, is simple. If you want the American people, or for that matter, folks in any country, to have genuine freedom of choice, to be able to choose between working in a top-down capitalist enterprise, on the one hand, or in a worker-owned and controlled, democratized workplace on the other, well, then you have to create those enterprises so people actually have a choice, can choose to work in one and another. And likewise, the rationale extends to the public in general. We should all be able to see what kind of experience it is to work in the one versus the other, what kind of products come out of it, so that we actually can evaluate these alternatives and decide which we want to have more of in our societies as an expression of what people want and need in something as important as their work lives, that which they spend most of their life doing as adults. Third option, labor unions. Labor unions could begin to think of themselves as they once did historically, as not only an agent that bargains collectively for the workers to get a better deal from the employer, but as also an agent to help workers, particularly unemployed workers, but workers in general, who would rather develop a worker-owned, a worker-operated, a democratically self-directed workers' enterprise. Why not have unions use some of their funds to help develop those enterprises as an alternative to being always in the position of reacting to what an employer does, typically when that employer tries to reduce the wages or the benefits workers have? Fourth example. What you could do is you could develop a tax. And this is an interesting idea. You tax corporations who decide to leave your city, your state, your country, and you tax them to achieve two things. One, there are going to be social costs when an enterprise that's been located in a place for years leaves. Upset lives, lost jobs, lost incomes, lost tax revenues. If we're going to say to the corporation, it's your decision, then the least the community could do is say, if you make a decision that imposes all kinds of costs on us, which you do because it enhances profits for you, then there's something wrong if we just leave you to make more money and the rest of us to pick up the costs of the damage you do as you leave to make more money. By the way, European countries, Germany in the lead, do exactly that. They put restrictions on companies in a way the United States does not. Suppose we taxed corporations. The money we got could be used, in part, to help fund cooperative enterprises, enterprises that the workers damaged by the corporation leaving would have first opportunity to avail themselves of. They could become the principals, the workers self-directed in that enterprise, funded by the tax on the corporations who are leaving, after all, to make more money. It's an interesting concept. It ought to be explored. Not the least of its virtues are that if the company knows it's going to have to pay a tax if it leaves, it might, in fact, think again about leaving, and for the people in the community, that's no minor matter either. Last thing, it's also possible to raise private money for worker self-directed enterprises, co-ops. There's no reason to exclude that. Here's an example. In a corner of, I'll pick a state, Indiana, a factory closes down for whatever reason, and workers are displaced, incomes are lost, tax revenue of local towns and cities is devastated, etc. Might there not be a way to appeal to everyone in the affected communities, cities themselves, churches, social groups, labor unions, other corporations which will be hurt by all of this, to chip in and buy shares in a new kind of enterprise, something that will keep the workers who lost their jobs when the company closed from becoming unemployed, by giving them a new kind of enterprise to throw themselves into, a worker self-directed enterprise whose money would be subscribed by all of those public and private business and individual supporters who would not only be helping those workers as an act of solidarity and charity, but would be helping themselves, because by providing those workers with a new kind of enterprise that they will throw themselves into because they own it, they run it, as well as work in it, they will also be helping themselves. If that enterprise gets going, it'll pay taxes, which will help the cities and towns and state. If that enterprise gets going, it will place orders to other enterprises in the environment, and that's good for them. And it will keep those people in their homes because they'll earn incomes and can sustain their mortgages, and that'll support housing values. You see the point? We could use even privately raised money to create this new, better way to organize work giving Americans a choice. And here's a final thought. If a company closes or leaves and is replaced, that is a capitalist company, by a worker self-directed enterprise, just think of how it could advertise its output of goods and services. We are a collective. We are citizens just like you. We've organized an enterprise that we ourselves run. And by keeping it going, you help us and you help yourselves. You can do something to offset the devastation when capitalist companies, for their own profits, pull up stakes and leave. Here's your chance to do something. Buy our products. Buy a share in our company to give us the money to make a successful enterprise. I think the American people would rally to it, and it would provide a source of money that would surprise many. The second major discussion topic for today's program has to do with economics education in the United States. And here I'm thinking about education at the level of colleges and universities. I want to talk about how that education now proceeds, and I want to talk about how it ought to proceed. First, let me begin with a comment. As a professional economist all my life, as a college teacher all of my life, and in recent years as someone who talks a great deal in public meetings, on radio and television, on the internet, about economics, I have to be honest with you and say that what we call economic literacy, the understanding of our citizens about the economic realities they face, leaves a good bit to be desired. Some things are well understood, but many are not. And I fault the education system for that. I think that between what you'd learn and don't learn in school and what is then transmitted on the mass media is not adequate as a way of equipping citizens in a modern society to understand and therefore successfully cope with what's happening in the economies upon which they depend. So let me review briefly what is taught in 95 or more percent of the economics curricula in colleges and universities across the world. And I really can say this because it has become a global situation, no longer limited to these countries or those regions of the world. One theory of economics prevails across universities and colleges, Western Hemisphere, Eastern Hemisphere. It is remarkable. And this theory is called by its formal name, neoclassical economics, but you can also think of it as mainstream economics. It's what mostly gets taught. And it is a theory which was begun by and has been developed by people who happen to believe that capitalism is a wonderful, positive economic system. Indeed, the best human beings have so far devised, and therefore to be celebrated and to be imitated where it doesn't already exist, and then to be fine-tuned because it is such a great thing to begin with. This theory speaks of efficiency as something capitalism maximizes, of equilibrium at a situation in which the economy is in good shape and has no intrinsic tendencies to leave that situation, and something interestingly called welfare. No, not the kind of welfare we talk about in terms of helping people with low incomes and so on. No, welfare in a different sense. That capitalism delivers the goods, that capitalism produces the goods and services on the one hand and the job opportunities on the other that really meet people's needs and wants. So that capitalism is efficient, capitalism tends to a stable equilibrium, and that capitalism produces the jobs and the outputs people want. That's the dominant theory. It's a theory that is increasingly in trouble for a simple reason. It's too far different from the reality most people live, and that is a death knell for all theories. When the reality, when the practical reality you live is a daily contradiction to the theory you're taught to believe, Something has to give. Sure, some people will rethink the reality to bring it in line with the theory. There are always folks that do that. But there will be plenty of people who go the other way and who begin to question the theory when the reality seems to demand it. Well, the mainstream has always allowed one kind of criticism, at least for the last 75 years. And this criticism says, yes, capitalism is wonderful. Yes, capitalism is efficient in general. And yes, it produces what people want, more or less. But it has flaws. And in particular, it has a tendency to be not in equilibrium. In other words, it's unstable. Things inside capitalism produce business cycles, periods of upswing and prosperity, but those are offset by periods of downswing, recession, depression. The chief theorist of this, let's call it mild criticism of capitalism, was the British economist John Maynard Keynes, who wrote his critique of capitalism in the depths of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And there he said, we have to face that the capitalism we all love and admire, he made that crystal clear that that was his view, that capitalism we love and admire has flaws and weaknesses. We have to face them, we have to understand them, in order to find solutions. And he did that. And in his great book, The General Theory, published in 1936 and studied by economists ever since, he developed the basic ideas which we now call monetary policy and fiscal policy that he thought could and should be used by the government to prevent, to offset, to shorten, to soften the instabilities, the cycles of capitalism. Monetary policy should be handled by the central bank, he wrote. And so it has been in the United States, for example, that the Federal Reserve, the name we give to our central bank, has been in charge of trying to cope with economic downturns in the way that the Federal Reserve is currently doing, by pumping money into the economy, new money, by keeping interest rates very low, and so on. Fiscal policy is what the rest of the government should be doing, using its power to tax and its power to spend the tax monies it raises to stimulate the economy when it's down and to limit it when it is booming along at too high a pace. So Keynesian economics is a mildly critical approach to capitalism. Most economics departments in most countries teach only the celebratory neoclassical economics. But a good number of them, particularly in down times like today, also teach some Keynesian economics. But what's missing from most economics departments, and it couldn't be more urgent to deal with this problem now, is an approach to economics that is fundamentally critical of capitalism. And by that I mean Marxism, because what Marx begins early in the 19th and middle part of the 19th century has been developed since then into the most developed, sophisticated, rich, and diverse tradition of analyzing capitalism, which was what most Marxists have always done, but from a critical point of view, from a point of view that capitalism isn't particularly efficient, that capitalism is wildly and uncontrollably unstable, and that capitalism does not, in fact, serve the needs and desires of the mass of people, but only for a small group at the top, those who own the means of production, those who make the basic decisions in boards of directors of corporations, and so on. The point is not to argue for or against Marxian economics as opposed to either Keynesian economics or neoclassical. That's not my point. My point is that it is unconscionable and indefensible to exclude Marxian economics from the curricula of our colleges and universities. Notice I'm not saying anything about socialist and communist economies, so-called. What have existed in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, the People's Republic of China, and so on. That's another matter. I think those economies should be studied to learn from their history, but that's another matter. I'm talking about analyzing the system that exists in most parts of the world called capitalism. And I'm insisting that to understand capitalism, to figure out its problems and to solve those problems, you need not only to study theories that love and celebrate capitalism, as both neoclassical and Keynesian economics fundamentally do, but you also need to study the critical approach, Marxian theory, because its focus on capitalism's weaknesses, flaws, its inefficiencies, its disequilibria, and its failure to meet people's needs are crucial. Marxian economics points to exploitation, something the other theories do not look at. It points to the inequalities and the lack of democracy that capitalism promotes. And again, the point is not to argue about whether it's right or not. It's to argue that you haven't been properly educated if you don't understand a critical perspective. Let me close this point with a metaphor. If you wanted to understand the family that lived down the road from you, that had a mother, a father, and two kids, and you knew that one of the children thought the family was the greatest thing that any family could be, but the other child thought it was a dysfunctional family that was psychologically messed up. If you wanted to understand the family, would you talk to only one of the two children, or would you think it was appropriate to talk to both of them? Needless to say, you'll draw your own conclusions. You will put together what you learn from both children to form your own opinion. But you need to hear both of them. Otherwise, you're not doing your own understanding any service at all. The same applies to economics, and it's long overdue to change that in the colleges and universities of this world. In this section of our program, I respond to some questions that you've sent in that I think represent many folks' concerns and interests. The first one has to do with pumping money into the economy at a downtime and what the risks are for inflation. This is a subject about which our political and media leaders are, and I'm going to be polite here, somewhat confused when they're not simply wrong and uninformed. Let's do this on a very basic level. When you have massive unemployment, when you have companies out of business, when you have goods and services not being produced, even though there are workers who want to work and all the tools, equipment, and raw materials needed for them to work on and with, one of the things the monetary authorities in a society do, the central bank, is pump money into the economy. Their hope is very simple, that if you give people more money, they will go out and spend it. They will want to buy more goods and services with the money, and that will lead store owners to say, wow, I can make more profits if I order more goods and services from my providers, from the companies that make the goods and services, so I'll be able to have them on hand to sell to the people who have the new extra money. So the idea is pump more money into the economy, and it will lead to more goods and services being produced, and that means more jobs for people producing the goods and services. That is the hope. Does that sometimes work? Yes. Does that lead to inflation? No, because the extra money doesn't bid up the price of goods, because the response to the extra money is to produce more goods. So the extra billion of money in the economy generates an extra billion of goods. The goods are priced at the same price as before, and they're paid for by the extra money that the economy has become equipped with, thanks to printing it by the monetary authority. So it is possible to stimulate an economy to offset unemployment by increasing the quantity of money if, and this is the big if the increase in money leads to the production of more goods and services to be exchanged for that money. Here's the problem. In a free enterprise system, the store owner, the factory owner, can choose, has the freedom to choose to respond to extra money in the economy, not by producing more goods and services to sell to the people who have this extra money, but to do something different. The manufacturer, or the retailer, or the wholesaler, or any combination of them, can choose instead to raise the price. Think of it in a simple image. Suppose extra money was dropped on the town in which you live from an airplane. One afternoon, money rained down from the sky. Everybody reached up and grabbed a handful of bills. Now, the local store owners would know that all the citizens in this town now have more money, and they'd be running to the stores pretty soon to buy things. The store owners would now have a choice to make. You could call your supplier and get more stuff to sell these people coming in with their new money. Or you could jack up the prices and soak up the extra money they have by charging more for the same goods you had before. If capitalists, businessmen and women, in charge of our stores, our factories, and our offices, respond to increasing money that the government pumps in by raising prices, then we will have an inflation. If they respond by ordering more goods to be produced, we will have what Keynes and others hoped we would have, an increase in employment and production and well-being in our society, and no inflation, even though we increase the quantity of money. Final point. That is why sometimes when governments have increased the quantity of money in the hope that it generates more production of goods and services and thus more jobs, but have found themselves frustrated by the pressure of companies to raise prices rather than to produce more goods, that the government has imposed something called a wage price freeze. We did that here in the United States back in 1971. Under President Nixon, and for the same simple reason. If the government forbids companies from raising their prices, and forbids, by the way, unions from raising wages, which is what President Nixon did in 1971 in the United States, well, then you make sure that your monetary policy works, because you increase the quantity of money, and you forbid, by law, by threatening to jail any capitalist who raises prices, any unionist who raises wages. Then you can be sure that the extra money finds its way into the purchase of goods and services rather than into the unwanted inflation. Last point, and we're running out of time. How would a group of educators, teachers, operate in the idea of a worker self-directed enterprise? Well, the answer here is simple. We want education to be responsible to the teachers, the parents, the community, and we already do that in the United States to a good deal with public education. That is, there are public elections of school boards in many parts of the world. There are public elections of political officials who have authority over the schools. So we try to make them responsible to the people through the government. The point would be to create schools that are run by the teachers in them, where the teachers are their own administrators, or rotate the administrators' function among themselves. That also exists. Magnet schools in the United States in recent years have made that experiment. There's a long tradition of that in the education systems of many countries. So I don't think there's the slightest problem. And I think we might understand an extra virtue of schools that were run by the teachers who became their own administrators rather than being controlled by administrators from above. If we want to teach our children the virtues the benefits of democracy, of self-government, then what better way to do that than having them see in action, up close and personal, how self-governing democracies work in the schools that they spend so many of their early years in, day in and day out. What a wonderful lesson in, laboratory in, democracy our schools could be and should be. And I think we'd see a lot of benefits socially as well as transforming the school experience, both for the teachers and the students. Thank you, as always, for your attention. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolff, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing gonna change, thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Further on up the road, babe. Thing gonna change, 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 baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change. Change, change, change.